This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries. Outrageously dependable. All right, everybody, this is the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast, and my boy Pierce here from the Wisconsin Sportsman podcast, that you can find both of our podcasts on the Sportsman's Empire podcast network. I just wanted to kind of put together a series this spring, and I'm not sure exactly what we're going to talk about in this series yet. We're going to call this the Spring Sessions, and just kind of shoot from the hip on what's happening right now, what's kind of going on in, maybe we cover conservation, we cover, it doesn't necessarily have to be whitetail related, but I just kind of wanted to get a session or a series going here this spring. And I said, I know a guy named Pierce who would do a really good job at this. I invited him and he said, yes, I'll do it. So Pierce, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, dude. I'm excited. Yeah. But what I read between the lines in your request was, you mean I get to have coffee with Dan every
coffee
morning?
Coffee with
one,
Dan.
One morning a week one, for the next couple of weeks? Let's go. Absolutely.
Let's go, buddy. Dude, and I almost think we live close enough to where we could have done this in person.
Oh, dude, we should find a coffee shop for like
we gotta find a coffee shop.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
Absolutely. And so, okay, that's a great conversation starter here. Coffee every morning, black, you put something in it, like flavor.
100% like, black every morning.
Yep. Yep.
Pot's black. Probably gone by like two.
Two? So you're an all-day drinker.
Oh, yeah, dude. Yeah.
All-day drinker.
Yeah.
Okay. Especially if it's cold outside or cool,
for sure.
Like it is this morning.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, dude, I'll drink coffee. I also, if you didn't know, me and Pierce spent an entire episode talking about bowel movements one in the past, but it helps me stay regular.
Yeah.
Right. So absolutely. I'm a huge fan of coffee and its benefits. I'm not sleeping well because of my knee right now. So, coffee kind of gives me exactly what I need, caffeine specifically. So good kudos to you. What brand of coffee do you drink?
Oh man, you know, we've dabbled with a handful of them. Before I get to that though, on the note of our poop episode, I was thinking this morning, I was like, 7:30 recording time.
That's a roll of the dice.
Isn't that going to conflict with Dan's schedule? Like,
yeah, it potentially could because
playing with fire.
Anywhere between now and 8:00. I might get a gurgle and I might just be like, all right, we're going to hit pause and I'll see you in about 5 minutes.
I'm ready for it.
My family jokes around with me a lot and they say, oh, Dad's on the pot for 2 hours. I am not a time wasting pooper. I hold it until I know I got to go. I go and then I'm there for maybe 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 10 minutes max. But I'm a dump and go guy. So
that's the way to do it. Efficiency, yeah, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Okay. Let's see. I want to have fun with this, with this episode and in this entire series, as well. So let's do this. Let's start off with some fun questions for you. Okay. And that fun question is, Pierce has been in the tree stand all morning. There's a wind shift. All right. He knows he's got to get out of the stand, take it down. Maybe you're on a piece of public, maybe you're on private. That doesn't matter, but there's a wind shift. You got to get out. Well, while you're out, it's time to go get some snacks or some food at the local Casey's or the gas station. What is your gas station snack of choice?
Dude, so I'm always a Quick Trip guy, a Quick Star guy, as you get further south, always a Quick Trip guy. Lately, my go-to has been, there's like those Fairlife protein shakes or whatever. I'll grab one of them out of the cooler. And then I'm either going to grab a sausage, egg, and cheese croissant breakfast sandwich off of the little hot rack there. Or if I'm feeling healthy, I'll run down to like the protein bar section and I'll grab one of these, like First Form makes these little protein bars that are like 20 grams of protein, but they're absolutely delicious. They're the only protein bar I've had that doesn't taste like absolute cardboard. And so that's been my go-to because it keeps me full for like the majority of the day. So usually it's like, especially right now with like guide season and stuff, like it's about 6:30 in the morning, get to Quick Trip, grab that stuff, pound it when I'm like pulling up to the creek, and then wait for the clients and get everything rigged up. But that usually puts me through till about noon. So
So I used to be the guy who would stuff his face, like, and then the afternoon hunts would be brutal because I'm sitting there like falling asleep. And so I've learned over the handful of years where I know that I either have to take a little nap before I get to the tree stand. If I don't, I got that sugar crash or whatever, all the carb crash or whatever. And I'm not, dude, I'm not loving it. I'm not loving my time in the tree stand.
Yep.
So one thing that I've learned is number one here, check this out. Number one, I don't drink caffeine. I don't drink coffee in the mornings before a morning hunt. For the reason that we talked about.
Okay, I was going to say. Okay.
But I have these little, I don't know if I have any next to me. No, I don't. They're in my truck. But it looks like chewing tobacco, but they're called grinds. Have you ever heard of those?
Oh, yeah.
And so I'll throw in a caffeine, like it's basically a coffee packet in like a dip. And that gets me the caffeine that I need going into that morning or going into the afternoon. But after my morning hunt, I'll usually drink a couple cups of coffee and then I just have my little toilet time later in the day. Now, here's what I used to be like. Tell me if those apple pies like a protein bar? I used to go.
I'm sure there's some protein in them. Maybe
there's some. Yeah, a little bit of protein, but basically just processed sugar. I used to get the apple pies, maybe a black coffee and apple pie, and then I'm also like a Casey's cheeseburger guy, or I don't necessarily do the pizzas or anything like that. But I've kind of learned to lay off the sugar now until like in the evenings, because dude, I just, number one, I don't like being full and I don't like having the sugar crash and for the afternoon hunts because you're starting to fall asleep and you're like, holy shit, dude, this sucks, man.
Yeah, dude, I totally hear you. I figured out in the morning, like the reason I switched to the like more high protein stuff in the morning was because when I ate sugary stuff, if I had like, I don't know, like a bowl of cereal, or I had like even like a more sugary granola bar or something like that, dude, after about 45 minutes, I would be freezing my butt off and I like shiver like crazy. Yeah. And then like I had it a couple of times where I'd go to draw back on deer and be like just shaking like a leaf and like just never felt stable. But like coffee and just like a solid, nothing crazy protein base seems to keep me pretty level headed, pretty clear. But I never really hopped on the Little Debbie train or anything though. For that reason.
When I go out west, I like to eat a lot of protein because it keeps you fuller longer. And from everything I've read, the protein takes longer to digest, which is why you feel full longer as opposed to like some sugars and carbs that they kind of go real quick. So, All right. There's that. And we'll dive into like maybe post meal hunts or post hunt meals and things like that for afternoon hunts and celebratory things as we get through the series here. But
dude, those grind pouches that you mentioned though, like that's a game changer.
That's a game changer.
If you're somebody who's like running and gunning and doesn't want to lug around a thermos of coffee and you know cut a couple pounds off, like those things are legit.
But I will say this: there are times when I go against my rule. Okay. There is nothing better than sitting in a tree stand on a cool morning, you know, that sun's coming up and maybe it's a slow morning and you're not seeing a lot of deer movement and it's still cool. and you drink a coffee in the tree stand, dude. There is, I don't know. That's as close to heaven as I think I'll ever get, man. Mm-hmm. Just in a tree stand, drinking a black coffee, a hot black coffee, dude.
Yep.
That's it for me, man.
Take the lid off and that kind of makes steam that little
comes up.
Yeah, it steams off. Exactly.
Then you dump it in. You dump it in the thermos. You dump it into the lid. You drink out of the lid. Yep. Yeah, man.
You got to get into that as soon as you're, I don't know, if you hit a slump in your season, that's how you start to slowly claw your way out of it. Yep. You got to start going back.
Bring a coffee to the stand.
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do that when I go out west too. So like I'll sit on if I'm having a morning where it's just like, I don't want to get up, I will pack my jet boil and my coffee, my instant coffee, mm-hmm. and I'll go sit on a glassing knob and glass a valley and boil coffee, make coffee and all that stuff too. So yeah, dude, it's legit. Like I don't know what is it though. Cause my wife's favorite part of the day too is having the first sip of coffee. What is it in your opinion about coffee that just is like a tone setter? Even in an afternoon, let's say you're dragging ass in the afternoon, you just have a warm black coffee and it changes the tone for the rest of the day.
Totally. Dude, I don't know. I think it's just gotta be almost at like a subconscious level at this point.
It's gotta
be. If you're a coffee drinker, like, I don't know, it's kind of like, that's your drug of choice, right? And so like you're going to wake up, you're going to catch a whiff of that, you know. Going down the street, you might turn your head, walk down an alleyway, you know, meet a guy behind a dumpster. He's going to pull some coffee out of a bag.
Oh, like, I was like, where's coffee, this right? going? Yeah. Where's this going?
Go to your local coffee dealer, you know, like.
Like, wait a second. Where's this going? Okay. I get it now. All right.
I would imagine it's the same thing. You know, I would imagine.
But I'll tell you this. I have never. Well, I take that back. Do you think a 5-hour energy is considered an energy drink? Is a 5-hour energy an energy drink?
Oh, that's tough, man. Yes. Yeah. Okay. I think it's like, I don't know. It's like an energy supplement at that point. It feels more so than a drink.
Yeah. Have you ever participated in the 5-hour energies?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Back when I coached high school football, that was our pregame ritual with the other coaches. We'd all get in a circle and pound one of those.
Okay. So 5-hour energy is one of those. It's like you're on the brink of coming back from a 10-hour drive or something like that. And you're like, okay, do I get a hotel? Or do I pound a 5-hour energy and get home like at 4 a.m. type of deal? And so I used to do the 5-hour energy. But dude, if you take those at the wrong time, you're up all night. But I will say this. I have never been a Red Bull guy. I have never been an Monster energy drink guy. Dude, I think those things suck ass. They taste like shit. And I just have not been a fan of them at all. What energy drinks do you, are you an energy drink guy or not?
Oh yeah. I mean, I try to stick to coffee. I'm a sucker for Red Bull. I really am.
Red Bull sucks. I hate it.
Oh dude. I can get down with a Red Bull. The Celsius are pretty killer too, but those things give you heart palpitations. So
yeah,
I don't know.
I don't want heart palpitations at my age. Heart palpitations, dude. That could be an ER deal. Yep. We went on a float trip. This is no joke. We went on a float trip and there was this guy, we called him Pat the Truth, right? And the reason we called him the Truth because he lied so much. So we just gave him the nickname of the Truth. Well, maybe he was telling the truth, but no one really ever fact checked him. Okay. Long story short, I watched him drink 24 Red Bulls and an entire fifth of vodka on a float trip. He's still alive, dude. So kudos to him.
That's insane.
That's insane, dude.
I remember in college, there was some, I don't know if it was a reputable source, but I remember somebody saying that like vodka Red Bulls or Jaeger bombs or whatever do the same thing to your like heart as cocaine or something.
No shit. I would not be surprised. Yeah. I would not be surprised. I've never done cocaine.
I've known some people who have done cocaine, but I've never personally done it. And so I don't know what it feels like. I have drank a lot of Red Bulls before, back in the day. I know what that feels like. So if cocaine feels like a lot of Red Bulls, then I'm not interested in that. Cause it sucked. Like the heart palpitations and things like that. No thanks.
Yeah. No thanks.
All right. All right. So before we waste an entire episode on nonsense, we should probably, do what I call the hard pivot and get into our next topic. But before we do, I want to send a huge shout out to the partners of the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast. And I'm going reverse order this time. If you're looking for a t-shirt with a deer on it, go check out fullsneakgear.com. That's my company. I have a really good inventory left. So go to fullsneakgear.com, check out my t-shirts and hats and buy one. There you go. Next on the list is Reveal Trail Cameras. These guys are doing some amazing things with their cell camera technology. And, I feel like if you're looking for a cell cam or a trail camera in general, go check out tacticam.com/cameras. And the app can be downloaded anywhere, like the Google Play app, all that stuff. Anywhere apps can be downloaded, go check that out. Next on the list is Code Blue Scents. If you're looking for real or synthetic deer urines, if you're looking for scent elimination products like field sprays, detergents, and body washes, if you're looking for my favorite, the Rope-A-Dope Mock Scrape Kit, dude, I use that thing all the time now, and it gets deer all year in front of my trail camera, which is another awesome way to collect inventory of the deer that are living on your farms. So go check out codebluescents.com, discount code NFC20 for 20% off. Next on the list, we're still sitting here with a lot of turkey season left, actually. And if you haven't checked out any of the red dots from Vortex Optics, go do that. Go put a red dot from Vortex on your turkey shotgun. Basically, all it does is it makes shooting your target easier. You put the red dot on what you want. You might have to have a little bit of an adjustment, but they're badass for turkey season. So vortexoptics.com, go check it out. Lastly, we have Wasp Archery. Go check out wasparchery.com, whether you're looking for a mechanical, whether you're looking for a fixed blade. Most of their heads are still manufactured in the United States, and they have some of the, in my opinion, some of the best, I guess you would call it, materials. And from a broadhead standpoint, it does exactly what you want, whether it's a marginal shot, whether it is a double lung, heart, whatever. They absolutely destroy whatever they touch. And that's the confidence that I need when I go to the woods. So wasparchery.com, discount code NFC20 for 20% off. Okay, Pierce. One thing that I've noticed on, especially today, on your social like platforms is you've been posting about some conservation. And what I mean by that is lack of conservation. It seems like throughout the state of Wisconsin and maybe a little bit in Iowa. Talk to me about why you're posting this and why it's important.
Man, I think the root of it is definitely just, and maybe it's, I don't know, a lot of things have happened over history that have been bad for conservation, right? And we're still here today. We're still able to hunt. We're still able to fish, all that sort of stuff. I think it all comes from still just like this sense of wanting to protect and improve and conserve what we have existing right now, and also wanting to set things up for the future, right? Like, I'm sure many folks have heard Doug Duren's line. You know, it's the whole motto of their nonprofit, Sharing the Land. It's not ours, it's just our turn. And so, like, how can we be good stewards of the land? How can we take care of things today so that our kids and grandkids can enjoy them down the road, right? And so that's really like the root of it, and just like not wanting to see wild places ruined, right? And so I'm sure everybody's heard all the stuff last year about the attempts for like the public land sell-off. We just had that bit with the Boundary Waters. There was a bill that was going to permit mining by a Chilean mining company not in the Boundary Waters, but in the river that leads into the Boundary Waters that creates that entire thing. And that was approved. So now it's open, or basically it was a 20-year mining ban that would protect that area, but it's been since removed as of last week, I believe, maybe the week before. But yeah, it's just,
and you know, they're thinking that as far as the boundary waters are concerned, they're thinking the runoff from that mine is going to affect the entire ecosystem.
Yep, yeah, exactly. Okay. Yeah. One pipe bursts, one, you know, you're messing with soils and stuff up there. It's all going to make its way eventually, just like anything, into the water or watershed, and it's going to flow down into there. Boundary waters are the most visited wilderness area in the country, I believe. And, you know, obviously an area that we'd want to protect and everything. And so, you know, on the national level, it's, you know, it's stuff like that. It obviously hits harder if you're somebody who lives near the boundary waters, if you're somebody who goes to the boundary waters every year. But there's stuff going on out west in terms of like dam removal, all sorts of stuff like that. At the end of the day, I think whether you're a hunter, angler, or I don't know, just a regular person.
Yeah.
If you've engaged with these things, if you've seen these things, if you took that vacation when you were a kid and you saw salmon running up some river, you saw you went on the field trip in grade school and you like went to the fish hatchery or the, you know, saw how pheasants are stocked, or like, you know, even if it's just stuff like that, you're more inclined to, like, I mean, at least from where I sit, if I were a kid going on a field trip, if I were somebody, a parent going on that field trip with my kid being exposed to something like that for the first time, I feel like you'd have a hard time being like, man, look at all these fish, or look at all these birds, or look at all this wildlife. I sure hate that. I sure don't give a damn about that. You know, like,
You know, it would be awesome to put a giant factory right here.
Exactly.
Or a mine right here. Yeah,
exactly. I get it. Exactly. I get it. And so that's kind of the root of it. But just recently, the Wisconsin DNR rolled out their budget for 2027, and there's quite, when now things weren't going great to begin with. Our, you know, DNR has been financially in a little bit of a compromised state for a bit. They transferred $30 million to that fund, the DNR fund, I guess, in an attempt to balance that fund. Now, that money is essentially there, but it's locked up. The DNR does not have spending authority to do anything with it. They're just trying to, I believe, balance the budget by putting those funds there. But because they can't spend that money, because they can't do that stuff, and because we're still trying to dig ourselves out of a hole, in 2027, this lack of funding would essentially mean they reduce pheasant stocking by 10,000 birds from 75,000 to 65,000. They reduce monitoring surveys for deer, grouse, and other species by 28%. So there's going to be less research being gathered and less surveys and studies being done. Mm-hmm. They're going to reduce the banding of waterfowl and other birds by 15%. So again, less research. Reducing wolf winter tracking by 20%. Again, less research. Reducing CWD testing by 10%. That one sucks big time. As a guy who hunts in a CWD heavy area, I'm right on the border of Dane and Iowa County, which Iowa County and Richland County are, I believe, our two highest density or our highest positivity rate counties for testing CWD. Man, nothing sucks more than shooting a deer, dropping the head off at the CWD kiosk or the testing station, whatever. Depending on what the weather does, you know, we'll get some 50 degree days in December. We'll get some, you know, colder days throughout, whatever. You don't know what you're going to get really these days as we kind of work through the end of the season. Nothing sucks more than having that carcass. If you're somebody who self butchers, you've got that carcass hanging in your garage or in your shed or whatever. If you don't have a cool place to store that, you got to get to it sooner rather than later. And oftentimes it's getting, especially later in the season, it takes longer and longer and longer to get that CWD testing result. If that's something that you're worried about, if you want to, if you're okay with eating CWD positive meat, who cares? If you're not, you have to wait, you have to quarter it up. Now, what I've figured out is the best way to do it is quarter it out, get your back straps off, get everything off the bone, but leave it in like big pieces and get it in a fridge. And basically just like keep it in there. Hank Shaw actually told me about this. Put them in your fridge, especially if you've got like an old beater fridge, like find one on Marketplace for like $50 or $100 or something that can just be solely the deer fridge. Doesn't matter how much blood gets in there, how much other, you know, what all happens, because it will get gross. But every day Like, let your meat sit in there on the rack, take all the racks out except for the bottom one, put a cookie sheet underneath it so that it catches all the stuff that drips off. Pop the door on that fridge once a day just to get some air circulating through there. That will buy you some time, usually. Obviously, you don't want to do it for more like 2 weeks. That gets a little dicey. But and then the other flip side of that, if you're somebody who takes a deer to a processor, you're paying, I mean, these days, $150 minimum, like probably more in that 200, 250 range, depending on how, like what you're going to have done with it. You're paying that money just to get that deer potentially back with a CWD positive result. Do you want that meat? Do you not? If not, then you're $250 in the hole. Now, I will say most of these butcher shops, whether you are a CWD, whether you're positive or not, exactly, the butcher shops do not handle the testing for you, and so they rely on you to do that. When you bring them a deer, if they're like, did you get it tested, and you say, yep, I already took it or got it tested, whatever, I'm like, okay, great, I'm gonna take your word for it, because this is going in a big meat grinder with a bunch of other deer. So if you're if you're somebody who's concerned with that, at least I think it's worth being aware that you're definitely eating meat that's got to have at least a fraction of CWD in it. And I'm sure we already have, right? Yeah. So the CWD testing results thing, like, or the testing reduction, that one sucks. And then on top of that, to round it all out, they're reducing forest habitat and grassland habitat management by 33% and 4% respectively, and reducing maintenance by 34% for public use facilities like parking lots, trails, and visitor centers. So our wild spaces are more likely to have the branch across the road, the full porta potty, the all that stuff, you know.
That along with the like the education part of it, like, because I can remember going to these nature centers as a kid, and that's where for the first time these youngsters have, you know, like, here's a snake skin, here's an Indian arrowhead, here is a deer antler. Like, some of these kids who are not in the outdoors, this is where they learn about wildlife for the first time, right, on these little mini school trips and stuff like that. So I definitely think that's important. I want to go back to CWD for a second. Do you eat CWD positive deer?
Same thing. I probably have at some point. I know that I have at some point. If I test positive now, I don't. Just not that it's contracted to humans or not. Maybe that's, I don't know. It's a tough line to walk, man, you know, because like there hasn't been any proof that it's been contracted with humans or, you know, transmitted to humans. But there's still like the little bit of psychological hurdle of like,
it is,
if I know this thing is sick, like if we had it on the, if it were on a grocery store, right? Like in the butcher shop, and there was a label, a big sticker on the front of that package that said CWD positive, I bet that stuff probably wouldn't move off the shelves very often, you know?
Yeah.
And so there's, you know, just that, I think the psychological hurdle of that, just knowing that you're eating a sick animal.
Yeah.
I'm sure you've seen deer that have CWD that are looking like zombies walking through. I don't know if you get them over by you. I've seen several times, like in downtown Richland Center, like pulling through there at 2 p.m. and there's just some mangy looking nasty doe walking through literally the downtown of Richland Center, like through the traffic light. Yeah. And you just kind of know, like, ooh, that's, that's not what we're after there.
Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue-collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue-collar workers for blue-collar workers. Workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies and hats for both men and women, Trollco represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Trollco has your back, literally. Head to trollco wix.com/chronicles and use NFC25 for 25% off your first order. Trollco, for the hardworking American. Summer is officially here. And you know what that means? Long late nights by the grill, weekends at the lake, and hitting the golf course with your buddies. And nothing elevates those perfect summer moments quite like a premium cigar. Whether you're pairing a rich Murado with a cold bourbon after a backyard barbecue, or enjoying a smooth smoke on the porch at sunset, Thompson Cigar has you covered. They've been America's humidor since 1915, offering the absolute best selection and prices. Because they have one of the largest humidors in the country, your cigars are guaranteed fresh and delivered straight to your door. If you want to try something new, check out their unique 5-pack fever deals or their value clubs for unbeatable savings and expert curation. Use my code NFC at checkout for up to 20% off your orders of $75 or more. Or visit thompsoncigar.com/NFC and the discount will be automatically applied. Some exclusions may apply. And you never know until you test them, because that could be an EHD deer too. That could be, you know, one of other several things, but it's crazy. I saw a little post online, and I don't know who did it. And it showed a picture of a deer in the final days of EHD and, you know, skinny, sunken in, starved, you know, just like that. And then it said the final days of a CWD deer, and it looked like a healthy deer, right? Just looks normal, right? So it's crazy. It's just, it's nuts. And so then to have less budgeting from state agencies to do the research on that stuff is, I don't know, it's a little bit disheartening. And we're going through the same things at Iowa, right? So it's like there's definitely budget cuts across the Department of Natural Resources. The thing that frustrates me the most is the amount of land that conservation officers have to cover in a, like in the state of Iowa. We're talking sometimes up to 2.5 counties. And so I call in a poaching charge and, or a poacher. I just saw some guy shoot a giant buck out of his truck window, and they would say, I'll be there tomorrow. Right. Like, dude, he's right here right now. Right. I'm sorry. I'll, you know, I can't come and check it out until tomorrow. Or I found it, you know, like that's just the reality of it right now. Mm-hmm. And then like, the other big one for the state of Iowa right now was water quality and, dude, you know, and fisheries. It's just like, holy shit, you're telling me that Iowa's water is on the border of being poisonous, if not already poisonous, and you're going to cut budgets to reduce the testing of Iowa's water or water treatment facilities. Get the fuck out of here, dude.
Yep.
Who are you trying to save? Because it's not the people of the state.
Well, that's the weirdest thing too, because it's like, aren't your kids drinking that water?
Yeah.
Aren't your grandkids drinking that water? Like, I'm presuming they live like remotely close to you, or they live in Iowa even. Like, where's the disconnect that you wouldn't want to leave something better for them? Like, why do you want your kids to drink poison water?
Exactly. Crazy. And so, like, here's the deal, man. Like, I'm sure you've seen it. The map of,
cancer rates.
The cancer rates versus like the distribution of cancer rates versus the distribution of Roundup Ready beans, nitrogens, and or God, what's the I'm looking for
like the glyphosate use
and the glyphosate usage. Mm-hmm. Yes, you lay those over top of each other, and it just identical. And maybe it's a coincidence, or maybe it's not. Mm-hmm. Right. And so it's just one of those things where it's like, I also heard a comment from a guy. He goes, eating deer in the Midwest is no longer like deer are a GMO. They're not natural. They're eating GMOs, which makes them not, they're not this like perfect species to eat anymore. Yep. They're influenced by genetically modified organisms, and therefore they are now a genetically modified organism, mm-hmm. just because of the corn and soybeans and the agriculture they eat. So they're not as clean as you want to, like, they're not free range, like this perfect meat, like you said, they say they are.
Right. Right. It's a good start. It's a step in the right direction. It's healthier than beef. It's leaner than beef. There's still the extra gram of protein per ounce that venison carries over beef. There's still all that. It's still a healthier meat, but to sit here and pretend that we're eating totally. And I think that's where it's, you know, we can rationalize, as hunters, especially, like, we often see the deer in the bean field, in the corn field, in that sort of stuff. I think that's where a big part of paying attention to hunting around, like, more diverse areas where they've got more native pollinators, they've got more native prairies and grasses and stuff like that. They maybe have that orchard where they can diversify the diet that much more, because they will gravitate. Like, they don't just eat soybeans all year round, or corn all year round. You know what I mean?
Right. Right.
They're constantly cycling. And so, like, the good news is, I guess, the silver lining, like, at least to my knowledge, there's no GMO white oaks in early October. Yeah. You know what I mean? There's no, so that you've got the differentiating factor there of, like, they're at least creating a more diverse diet there. And that's kind of where, like, with all these cuts and everything, a lot of this, I was looking it up last night, you know, Wisconsin's 82% privately owned, right? It's 82% private owned. I think Iowa's in the same area. It might even be higher. I think it's 90
Iowa is 90. Iowa is 98%.
Is it 90, really?
98 point. Yes. I believe the only state who has less public land than Iowa is Kansas. So I think, Kansas is one, and, Iowa is number two for most privately owned acres.
Mm-hmm.
So
there, to that point, then the DNR, in either state, doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. The DNR can only do, like, all these stocking programs we're talking about around public land and public lakes, public resources, mm-hmm. whatever. The majority of deer, in theory, 98% of deer live on private land. 84% of deer in Wisconsin live on private land, presumably. You know what I mean? Yeah. Obviously, you know, if you're a public land hunter, it might always seem, or might not seem that way. But the majority of this stuff, in my eyes at least, starts to fall on the shoulders of private landowners, which already have a lot on them. But from where I sit, like, as I read that, you know, article last night in that news headline just about these budget cuts and the reductions in stocking efforts, it couldn't be more important now to do everything we can to protect the existing resources that we have. You know what I mean?
Right.
So even if it's little stuff like doing the habitat work, throwing a pollinator blend in your freaking backyard, like, maybe it brings bees, maybe it brings a couple more songbirds. Like, if we're lucky, like, if we're in a suburban area, we're probably not going to have a pheasant nest in there. But, you know, it's going to create habitat. It's going to create better soil near your home. And that will, you know, I don't know. I'm of the mindset that even the little things help, right? Like, doing the little stuff. But if you're somebody who's got a farm, or you lease a farm, or you, your grandpa's got a farm or something like that, volunteering in January to help do some TSI, to help do maybe a burn in the spring to help improve the soil, to maybe start looking into what are some of the little projects I can do around here that would do a, like, that would benefit everything, not just deer, not just, you know, it doesn't have to be a food plot, but I mean, shit, there's companies in Iowa, Hoxie Native Seeds. They've got a totally native blend of food plot mix that works. Like, it's all native plants. It's all pollinators. It's all native grasses. And it draws wildlife, not just deer. Like, there's two different food plot mixes they have. One of them's kind of like more deer oriented. One's more, I think, just like general, I believe. Yeah. Don't quote me on that. Go check out Hoxie Native Seeds to check that out. But I know that just from speaking with a couple of land managers, there's a dude, Thomas Mills, now, who does some holistic approach to land management, especially specifically for whitetails. The amount of nutrients in a lot of those native pollinators and grasses and legumes and flowers and all that stuff, especially for like does as they're, well, one, like the protein and phosphorus and all that good stuff for antler growth, but also for milk production for the does to, you know, create healthy fawns and sustain them throughout their, you know, early months, which as we all know, that's what creates bigger deer, is having good habitat when they're young, especially when they're in gestation. So doing little stuff like that, and as much as I hate to say it, because I hate the pay-to-play model of the outdoor space, right? I absolutely hate it, because I think it's something that should be available to all people. But if you can, man, because like those little projects, they cost money. You have to rent equipment. You have to find somebody with a tractor. You got to drive out to the farm. You got to do all that stuff. You got to buy the seed. If you can join like a conservation organization, like a Turkeys for Tomorrow, a Pheasants Forever, Ducks Unlimited, Trout Unlimited, those conservation organizations that have a little bit of extra funding that aren't as bound by the federal budget or the state budget, that have a little bit more lateral movement where they can go out and they can say, hey, we're actually going to invest some of this money. We're going to take some of these membership fees. We're going to put it into purchasing a new piece. We're going to put it into maybe more education for private landowners. And so I think it's starting to fall back on the hunter's shoulders, or the angler's shoulders, the conservationist shoulders. Yeah. And to round it all out, you know, kind of, we started this talking about the field trip and the, you know, exposure to, you know, getting people interested in it so that they at least have a small horse in the race. Now's the time, like, I mean, springtime in particular, turkey season, like now's the time to like take people fishing, take people turkey hunting, like invite them out. If you got a neighbor or whatever, who's, you know, maybe not into it. Maybe they're curious. They've seen you, you know, I don't know, skinning a deer, like on your truck bed or something. And, you know, you made eye contact. You didn't say anything. We just kind of like waved or whatever. Like maybe that's time to, you know, bring over a little backstrap peace offering, invite them over and say like, hey, you want to come check this out? Like, I'm going to go fishing. I'm going to go turkey hunting. You want to come with? Like, no pressure to pull the trigger or anything. We just figured I'd extend an offer. Like, get people engaged with it. Cause then whether they hunt or not, whether they buy a license or not, they're now a stakeholder in these wild spots.
Yeah, that's a fact. I like that idea. I will say this. It's so true. Habitat's so important. And obviously the states are bound by federal and state budgets and how much gets divvied up to counties and all that stuff. And that's and it just seems like there's less of that money coming in. And I don't blame them. Right. Mm-hmm. But I will say this. So my dad inherited 80 acres from my grandpa and grandma. And so he took his 80 acres and he cut it in half. So there's a long story short, 40 that got put into CRP. Okay. It got put into CRP. He planted trees in the low spots along this like creek that's only really wet when it rains. It's pretty much just like a runoff drainage in the middle of farm country, northern Iowa. All right. Everywhere you look, it's all ag. Okay. And so he's like, I'm going to cut this in half and I'm going to put it in the CRP program and I'm going to plant some trees. The trees he got for free because most of them, I think, because of a wildlife, I don't know what you would call it, like a rewilding thing where you can, the state some will give you trees
money or something.
The state will help you with the CRP seed and things like that. They will even come in and help you plant and they'll do the layouts and things like that. And so my dad took 40 and put it in CRP, planted trees. And even food plots, like foods, berries, bushes, and things like that, that wildlife will eat. And not just, you know, quail, pheasants. You know, when you bring that stuff in, you see the birds of prey, the hawks, the falcons, things like that, the osprey. Totally. So since he's done that, you're looking at a barren ground, black dirt, till over. Right. You know, like turn the dirt over to this new habitat and instantly. And I mean, within 1 year, there's been an uptick in turkey. There's been an uptick in, does. I mean, I think he has a doe live on his farm all year in the grass. Right. And there's a river bottom, I would say half a mile to the west of west of where he's at that holds a lot of deer and turkey, but instantly he's got more deer, more turkey, more pheasants, more pollinators, more everything on his, on his property. Mm-hmm. He is now set to do the same project with the other 40 where he's going to be, this would be a south facing slope, put CRP. He's going to plant some, evergreens. He's going to plant some, more trees on the opposite side of the creek and take that 40 out of production too. And so this is just kind of like a project. My dad, he doesn't necessarily need the cash rent, because he's going to be making a little bit of a profit through the CRP program again, that was kind of a knock on wood. Like nobody really knew if the CRP program for a while there this past year was going to get budgeted. Mm-hmm. And they're like, imagine the CRP program going away and how many acres of habitat that was going to be of wildlife habitat was going to be taken out of the state of Iowa.
Yeah.
I believe it was like hundreds of thousands of acres.
Yeah.
Of habitat that people would have just been, well, I'm not making money off of this. I might as well till it all up and put it back into production, row crop mm-hmm. production. And so that would have been pretty brutal for wildlife in the state. So
big time. Well, let alone the water quality, like you said. I mean, those are the plants that do the filtering. Like you put those things along that riverbank. That's what holds the mm-hmm. soil in place, prevents erosion. That's what like filters out all those pesticides that are falling in there, and it keeps them out of the water. Like, some of your pollinators might die off because they're just taking the brunt of that. But
absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So what I'm saying is in case you were needing or you didn't know, that stuff instantly starts to save wildlife. It mm-hmm. instantly means it increases the carrying capacity of pheasants, turkey, and deer in that area. And so now when my dad goes to put another 40 of CRP in on his farm, he's going to see almost that entire thing double. And really what it's doing is it's making a sanctuary for these animals, because as of right now, he knows that I hunt. And I'm sure if I said, hey dad, I want to do a pheasant drive in the CRP, he'd let me. But as of now, he doesn't let anybody else hunt on it. He doesn't let anybody hunt on it. It's kind of just a sanctuary for wildlife in this area. And I'm really looking forward to kind of seeing what his plan and what he's done. And really, he's kind of going against the grain in that area. And he's making time for wildlife, which is pretty sweet to see, dude.
Yeah, definitely, dude. And it's like, it's like you said, it's not just the pheasants, it's not just the birds and the mice and the insects and stuff like that benefit from it. Like you create that bedding spot for a doe, you create that sanctuary spot for that, you know, target buck of yours that's going to lay up in the tall grass until last light, and then you see him get out and you'll like think you blink and you think you're in Kansas or something like that, hunting some wide open field. Like, dude, I've seen it time and time again too, and I don't know exactly what the how do I describe this? Like the oak savanna thing is mm-hmm. like often talked about, where you've got a lot of these big oak trees, which I learned from that same Thomas Milstein guy. Oak trees alone create homes for, I believe, over 300 species of moths, butterflies, and birds. Like they live in the bark and they do all that stuff, let alone the squirrels, let alone the deer that eat the acorns, all that sort of stuff.
Ants, like, bugs, microbes, mushrooms, like everything. Yeah, exactly. Dude, I get it. Yeah.
Like when you start, I don't know, man, like obviously we don't hunt any of those things. You know what I mean? But when you start looking at a tree, and you can sit there in a tree stand on a slow morning and you can look across and you can see, like, you know, that shagbark hickory where all that bark's peeling off and looks all gnarly like that, I bet there's a couple hundred freaking bats tucked up under that bark right now.
It could be.
That's wild. Yeah. You know what I mean? And you start like just making those connections. I don't know, man. It makes you feel more part of the ecosystem when you are at least aware of the stuff beyond just like, well, the buck comes through this pinch point on November 4th every freaking year and he's going to come down here and you might check that scrape in that bedding area over there. Like, it's fun. It's fun when you're hunting. It's good to know. Yeah. But like,
there's been an owl in that hole in that tree for 2 years now. And, you know, that hole has produced, you know, maybe 5 baby owls in the last 2 years or whatever the case is, you know? And so it's a butterfly effect, right? Yep. You cut down that tree and then it just destroys everything, or you till that up and it destroys everything. And mm-hmm. I'm not going to sit here and hate, because I come from a line of, like, my bloodline is farming.
Yep.
And same. Agriculture and livestock in the state of Iowa. I mean, that's mm-hmm. where I came from. And so I get to, you know, it's a balancing act, you know.
Totally.
I have a question, though, about, I know you are a supporter of backcountry hunters and anglers. Okay.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. And in the past, I've been a big supporter of some of these other nationwide type programs, conservation organizations, the National Deer Alliance, the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, things like that, you know, Pheasants Forever. How do you feel when you are working or you're giving your money to backcountry hunters and anglers, knowing that it is a nationwide program?
Man.
And that some of your dollars may leave the state of Wisconsin
mm-hmm.
or Iowa. Where you're
the thing with BHA is what we kind of touched on earlier. Wisconsin's 84% privately owned. Iowa's 98% privately owned. Mm-hmm. We've got our public lands. We do what we can with them. But most of the public lands in this country are out of our states, right?
Right.
They're further out west. They're in these national wildlife refuges. They're in these, which can't hunt in a refuge, but like they're, you know, in these BLM properties, in, you know, all these different spaces. And I think it's the kind of thing, I mean, shit, you're a Western hunter. You benefit from these lands. So knowing that, like, the membership due is going to go hopefully to, you know, putting on some stuff in your own state, in your area where you've got, you know, you're going to see some sort of a kickback a little bit. You're going to see a cleaner,
yeah.
you know, when they do those trash pickups, when they pick up, you know, cut out all the barbed wire from an old property or something like that that used to be farm, do stuff like that. When they do the education programs, I mean, shoot, Wisconsin's BHA chapter, actually at the Vortex headquarters, just did a Western hunting workshop, like an intro to Western hunting kind of thing. So the events come in all shapes and forms. And I mean, shit, even pint nights, you know, just getting to meet some other dudes who are, and gals who are really great outdoorsmen who love the same stuff that you love. I mean, like the number of friends I've made since joining BHA is just through the roof. And like the interesting people who have different backgrounds, and some guys are like, you know, one Renaissance guy who's like super into coon hunting still and still runs dogs and all that sort of stuff when nobody else is doing that. It's like, dude, tell me more. That's interesting. Like, what are you seeing like from your perspective as a coon hunter versus these other guys' perspective as muskie fishermen? You know what I mean? Like, you get to just get a bunch of different perspectives from your own state and kind of come together around that state, but also know that, hey guys, let's go do that muley hunt, or let's go do that elk hunt or caribou hunt or whatever it is. You know that you've got an organization where some of your money is going to helping this organization stand up on behalf of you for these public lands, and you know you're going to get that kickback. And that's the hardest thing, right? Because especially over the last year where so many people are, there's so much going on in the public land space and there's so much going on in the conservation space that it's like you kind of get like you almost get whiplash because you're trying to figure out like, okay, wait a minute, what's the issue? What's the bill number? What's the, like, who do I send this to the senator? Do I send this to my congresswoman? Do I or my governor? Like, where does this go? Does this have to go all the way up to the top? Like, hold on a sec. So having a group like BHA, which if you're somebody listening to this who has wondered how you get in touch with these people, backcountryhunters.org/take action is the best way to do it. You don't have to be a member. You don't have to pay membership due or anything like that. But you can literally go in there, click on the state, punch in your zip code or your address or whatever, and it will basically feed you a pre-outlined email that you can review. You can tweak stuff. You can add stuff, cut it out, whatever. But basically sets everything up for you. So all you have to do is hit send and it goes to the right person. Or it's even got scripts where you can, you know, say if you want to call instead and leave a voicemail, go ahead and do this. Like, here's the talking points. Like, they make it so unbelievably easy for hunters and anglers to stand up on behalf of public lands and conservation issues by just keeping everything organized and outlined, which makes it easier for us to just be able to log in and be like, yep, on board.
Yeah.
Great. Sounds good. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, I feel that. So here's where I kind of sit on a teeter totter with that.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Cause I was a member and like, I really do feel a lot of these nationwide organizations do have the wildlife's best benefit, like in mind, right? They're like the National Deer Alliance, the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, the Wild Turkey Federation, right? They are the pinnacle of wildlife conservation. And I think they're doing really, really good things. However, this is where I've always kind of been frustrated about conservation. The bigger the conservation organization, the more money it takes to run the organization, meaning the more money needs to be donated and or, you know, because if you got a CEO who makes $100,000, well, then he needs to be paid $100,000. Then you got a secretary. Well, she needs to be paid something. Then you got all these wildlife biologists and they all need to be paid something, right? And I'm not, because that's important. You need people for conservation efforts. And I just, I got this feeling a couple of times and I could be in the wrong, man, but I was just like, I'm generating a membership, maybe even if it's the most basic $35 a year or $40 a year towards this, where's it going? Even if it's just the bare minimum a membership that some of these organizations offer, where's it going?
Yep.
Totally. And then you read about some of these programs. It's like, okay, well, it went to this place in Tennessee. Well, I've never hunted Tennessee. And I'll tell you what, the most satisfaction that I ever got out of conservation was this. A long time ago, me and a couple buddies, we built wood duck houses. Okay. And then they went and put them up in this marsh. And guess what? I got to drive down the road and I got to look into that marsh and I got to see the wood duck house that I built. And I got to see wood ducks fly in and out of that wood duck house. And I was like, that's such a satisfying feeling,
totally,
knowing that I was responsible for that duck living in that. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I said to myself, I go, well, if I can do that on a local level, there's gotta be other things that I can do at a local level that will help impact the deer hunting, that will help impact the habitat and things like that. And so I started participating more in local things because I get to see the direct effect of what I was doing in that. Even in the state of Iowa, where there's only less than 2% public lands for hunting, I got to see things change. And so, like when I took around the 4th, after the 4th of July, we were on a roll there for a handful of years. This last year, we didn't do it because of some, you know, outside reasons. And by the way, that's just an excuse. But we went to all of the parking lots and picked up trash. And we would pick up truckloads of trash. And I mean, people throw away ridiculous things at public land parking spots. And so we did that. And then guess what? The next time I drive down the road, that piece of trash is not there. And I say, we did that, kids. We made that parking lot cleaner. Mm-hmm. We picked up all of the fireworks that no one wanted to pick up and things like that. And so that was pretty sweet, you know, pretty sweet to see. So I would always suggest to people, if you're unsure about where your money goes on in a big nationwide conservation organization, that dollar amount or your time you can see a direct reflection of that at a local level. And you can go to if you love butterflies and bees, dude, you could go and help the county conservation organization in in the state that I live in. I know that in the county that I live in, they got a specialist that deals with grass and pollinators and things like that. And they're always looking for volunteers to go do things. If you love to fish and you want fish habitat, dude, they're always looking for volunteers to go do that. And then you can say to yourself, I put this bobber on top of this fish structure that I helped create. or, you know, I can go in and I'm not going to say chop down trees and shit like that. But if you want to go in and remove invasive species, they're looking for people to help do those types of things.
Yep.
And it's there, and it's more of a time thing than a budget thing, but you get to see the direct impact that your time and dollar has on something. You get to see it in real time, not in some gigantic mountain project that you're never going to be able to hunt, or a bedding program on private land that you're never going to be able to go and hunt on or get to go see. So, if that's okay with you, I'm not saying I'm against it. I'm just saying there's local opportunities too for, outdoorsmen and just nature enthusiasts at a local level too.
So, absolutely, man. Like you hit it on the head there with the conservation organizations, because like, holy smokes, do they get after it. Like, I know in your county, I know in my county, they get to freaking work. And like you said, there's a lot of different events out there that they do and different volunteer opportunities. So if it's the kind of thing where, hey, I've never done any timber stand improvement, I don't even know what they have to do, there's a volunteer opportunity where you can go in there, you can learn from experts, literally, and then you can take that knowledge back to your farm or to the farm that you hunt. You can offer it up. If you're somebody who's looking for private land access, I mean, that's a really good way to get on properties. If you say like, hey, like I drove by, like I'm, you know, looking for a place to hunt, you know, in exchange for permission, I'd be thrilled to go in. I could clean up that woods for you. I could get some of those deadfalls out of there. Here's what that would do for your habitat. If you're open to it, you know, if people say no, obviously don't like forced timber stand improvement upon them, but, you know, still just, it's something that's going to make you more knowledgeable. You're going to know what you're doing. You're going to know what to look for. It'll make you a better freaking hunter, because we all find spots on public and private land. They're like, ooh, this looks exactly like, here's what this is doing. And when you can understand the why behind it, it leads to that much more confidence, leads to better setups, and makes you just that much better of an outdoorsman.
Yeah. And that's a fact. So the last thing I want to talk about here is, you mentioned something that your county and my county are big into conservation efforts. And I'm going to say something, and I don't know if it's a hot take or not, but I am not a liberal from your traditional liberal versus conservative standpoint, right? But I will say this, my county votes liberal in all elections.
Yeah.
And my county is probably also a potential leader in the state of Iowa for conservation efforts. Okay. So there's this hand in hand, like there's this balancing act, even on a political standpoint, right? They might not agree with my hunting, but they agree with the habitat work that allows me to hunt or have better wildlife habitat on said public lands, or, you know, like no sprays. Like a big one in the state of Iowa is these landowners will put no spray, and so the county won't spray any weeds in front of their house or in their ditches or things like that, or mow it. And that creates habitat for wildlife, quail, pheasants, nesting birds, things like that, snakes, ants, you know, you name it. And so you don't necessarily see those in hugely conservative type of political landscapes, right? And so that's where I think, especially at a local level, there's an opportunity for the political side of things to see crossover, where it's like, I'm a hunter, I care about the habitat and the wildlife just like you do, but I'm going to go try to kill something off of it. And they would say like, oh dude, I don't want you to kill anything off of it, but we have the same thing in mind. Cause if you don't kill anything off of it, then it comes overpopulated, deer get hit by cars, you know, I wouldn't worry about turkeys right now, but like these things all have crossover, and it's a great opportunity for hunters, despite what your political beliefs are, and other people who are maybe love wildlife but are not hunters, and maybe even disapprove, like dis do not approve of hunting, have conversations. It's an opportunity there to do those things. And so I don't know, it's pretty sweet to see.
Definitely, dude. And like the political charge of hunting or being an anti-hunting, that's like, I mean, a fairly recent phenomenon. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like it used to not be a left or right aisle issue. Like even like your more conservative states, your more conservative representatives and stuff like that. Back in the '90s, yeah. Dude, everybody was an environmentalist, if that's the yeah. term you want to use. Of course, now it's got some charge to it, but like back then it yeah. didn't. You know what I mean? Like this is a recent, like last, you know, decade or two type thing that like mm-hmm. it's starting to just be used for leverage and not to sound any sort of way, but like that's kind of like what it seems like the tone or the strategy is to drive a wedge between us as citizens, is to get yep. us disagreeing on as many things as they possibly can so that they can keep lining their pockets and they can keep doing shit behind the doors that yep. doesn't benefit us. So,
yep. And that's where, like going back to the water quality thing, something tells me there's greed involved.
Totally.
Especially in the state of Iowa and other Midwestern states where no one wants the truth to get out because somebody's pockets are going to be affected by that. Right.
Yep.
And so that's just, it's truly unfortunate that, mm-hmm. you know, it's that the average Joe is suffering because of money or something like that. So,
yep.
Yeah. Well, this was a really good conversation, a serious one. You know, we didn't talk about fecal matter the entire time, which is pretty sweet, right?
Slipped it in there, but yeah. Not-
yeah, we got it in at the beginning. But I'm looking forward to many more of these conversations with the Nine Finger Chronicle Spring Sessions. Man, I really appreciate you taking time out of your day to hop on and BS. For those of you who are new to the Nine Finger Chronicles, go to iTunes or Spotify, leave a 5-star review, subscribe to that so it comes directly. Also, the Nine Finger Chronicles is on YouTube, so if you want to see our beautiful faces while we have this conversation, go do that as well. So good vibes, everybody. Be safe, and we'll talk to you next time.